hppodcraft.com.
I had never entered the lakeside retreat before, though I had often begged the trapdoor lover, as we used to call Eric in my country, to open its mysterious doors to me. He always refused. I made very many attempts, but in vain, to obtain admittance. Watch him as I might, the darkness was always too thick to enable me to see how he worked the door in the wall on the lake. One day, when I thought myself alone, I stepped into the boat and rowed toward that part of the wall through which I had seen Eric disappear. It was then that I came into contact with the siren who guarded the approach and whose charm was very nearly fatal to me.
What I really need to do is find myself a trapdoor lover, one who really loves some traps and is the Phantom of the Opera.
I think the siren song sounded a little like that.
Well, are you trying to say that Pete Burns from Dead or Alive is the Phantom of the Opera?
Well, actually, in that song, I think he's Christine. But if you want to work Trapdoor Lover into a song, Dead or Alive is the way to go. I've been working on these. They all work.
Uh-huh.
Trapdoor Lover, come back to me. You don't have to knock on my trapdoor. Literature is all about making connections between stories set in the 1880s and bands that peaked in the 1980s. At least that's our approach, and we're applying it today to Gaston Leroux's novel, The Phantom of the Opera, here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're here at hppodcraft.com and, of course, Patreon.
That reader, once again, was the talented and knife-crazy Jamie Andrews, just as good at reading as she is at stabbing. How many people can you say that about?
Not many.
Not many at all. This is the final climactic episode on The Phantom of the Opera. Let's do a really, really quick catch-up. The Phantom is this disfigured but talented guy, Eric, who lives in the cellars of the Paris Opera House and is in love with the singer Christine Daae, whom he has abducted once before but let go on the condition that she'd visit him and continue to take singing lessons from him. I guess he needs the business because apparently the flyers he's been posting at the local community college aren't getting a lot of response from other students. It just says, "Learn from the Angel of Music!" And then instead of ripping off a phone number to call, it just says, "Stare into a mirror and call for Eric. Reasonable rates." Nobleman Raoul de Chagny is in love with the classless singer Christine and plans to run away with her after she gives one more performance at the opera, but Eric learns of this plan and steals Christine away right from the stage as she's performing. Raoul plans to find her underneath the opera, and luckily the Persian shows up to aid him, another mysterious fellow who's been lurking around and has a history with Eric.
Now we finally get into the Persian and Eric. It's been a long time coming.
Yes, we're getting this account of the action directly from the Persian in this chapter and going forward for a few chapters. It's a written account that he gave the author, Gaston Leroux, directly, or we're supposed to believe that. And this comes right in the middle of a cliffhanger. If you'll remember, Raoul and the Persian opened a trap door to try and gain access to Eric's lair from a way other than the lake and wound up falling into the Phantom's torture chamber. So now we backtrack a little bit, and the Persian tells about how he tried to get to the Phantom's bedroom before.
The Persian took a boat across the subterranean lake and heard this enchanting singing coming from nowhere in particular.
"You spin me right round, baby, right round, like a trapdoor lover, right round, round, round."
That was really clumsy trapdoor lover insertion.
It worked for me.
It's their biggest hit. It's their biggest.
Yeah. Now, the Persian was a bit superstitious, but even so, he knew that this must be a trick that Eric was pulling on him.
Right.
However, he was still so intrigued by this music because it wasn't coming from anywhere in particular that he looked into the water to see if there was somebody in the water or by the water somewhere around there. And when he leans over the edge, these two monstrous arms shoot out and they pull him down.
Yeah, it's just like young Jason's first appearance in Friday the 13th. That's what I thought
it
of
is.
Right away. This deformed guy coming up out of the water to pull you out of the boat.
It was Eric, and the Persian called out, and fortunately for him, Eric recognized his voice, and he pulled him to the bank. And the Phantom said, "Don't be creeping around here. You saved my life once, and I'm sparing you right now, but one day, I might not. Nothing can restrain Eric, not even Eric himself." The Persian states that Eric is vain and very full of himself, and he loves to do tricks on people so that they marvel him. Eric learned the siren trick from some Tonkin pirates who could hide for hours in riverbeds.
He's basically using a snorkel. So I don't know why they're blowing it up like it's this huge trick, but he uses a long reed to breathe and sing through while he's underwater. I was thinking I'd like to see that demonstrated because how good can that singing be? Does it really rise to siren quality when you're singing through a reed?
Well, maybe if you practice enough.
I guess so. I just imagine that it would sound more like a kazoo or something coming out of a reed, but But sure. The thing about that, though, is that Eric is vain enough that even if he plays a trick on you, his weakness is that he wants you to know how he did it.
Right.
He's so proud of his own ingenuity.
So the Persian reminded Eric that he promised he wouldn't murder people anymore.
Yeah, apparently Eric, he promised sometime in the past not to kill people. It's a little like Terminator 2, I think.
Eric was like, did I kill people? Oh, yeah, well, I never keep my promises. So the Persian asked Eric about the chandelier, but Eric said it wasn't him. It was just old and it was broken. He also calls the Persian Daroga, which is Persian for chief of police. Eric said, never come here again or I might have to dedicate my requiem mass to you. So after that, the Persian gave up getting into Eric's lake house via water.
Well, I don't blame him. You know, Eric's got the whole Dead or Alive back catalog to work with when he's doing that siren song thing. He hasn't even touched New Cleopatra. Not a lot of people know about that record, you know.
Oh, I do.
That's a powerful one. But the Persian continues to explain his backstory with Eric. They had known each other in the Middle East. The Persian had saved his life, as he mentioned, and later tracked his whereabouts to the opera house.
He heard stories about this opera ghost, and he suspected it was Eric.
He was worried about what the fiend might do, and so he's been watching him for a long time. Although in this encounter they had at the lake, Eric told him he wasn't going to be ornery anymore. He says, no, I've changed ever since I was loved for myself.
Now, this seemed crazy to the Persian, because he thinks, well, who would love an ugly, evil nut job? Mm. And he was thinking, you know what? This is going to all come crashing down. Whatever delusion he's suffering under, reality is going to slap him in the face. And yeah, he is going to go nuts and do real harm to people.
There's an interesting variation in the translations here, because we're using the Trapdoor Lover translation that's available online. And that one says, the way in which he spoke of his love affairs only increased my alarm, for I foresaw the cause of fresh and more hideous tragedies in this event to which he alluded so boastfully. And then in my Penguin's Classic translation, it says, the tone of his voice when he boasted of his newly found love only served to further my anxiety. Having heard it before, I dreaded that it might foreshadow new and more appalling atrocities. Hmm. All this is saying is that, in both examples, is that he's heard this boastful tone before. He knows it's bad news. But that little nuance in the second translation of having heard it before kind of suggested to me that he heard it before in this context. You know, i.e. the Phantom has had some sort of obsessive love affair thing before back in the other country. And that's why this love is, quote unquote, newly found. And I think even in the first translation, he says love affairs, plural. Mm. So, I don't know whether that's really trying to be suggested or not, but it made me think of what is the element of horror in this book. It's kind of a gothic romance, but what is the scary thing that puts this into that genre? There's lots going on thematically that we talked about, but I think the scary element is simply being the object of somebody's obsessive, unrequited love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I think modern audiences can understand how terrifying that can be. And I think it's the core component of the whole fatal attraction, single white female, the crush, that psychological thriller genre is kind of templated here, really.
Right, yeah.
And when I was thinking about that some more, I'm going, you know, that is kind of a primal fear, because we all want to be loved. So we're vulnerable to it. You know, it's at a basic level. That's what we want more than anything. So we change our appearance, we work on our personality. But what if the love comes from the wrong person?
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of this Greg Giraldo joke where he said, you know, he had a friend, a woman who was complaining, you know, hey, I show a little cleavage because I want to attract the right guy, but then all these slobs are interested in me. Greg Giraldo was like, yeah, I get it, but you have to understand cleavage is not a smart bomb. You know, you might get the right guy, but you're also going to get the guy on the bus with one tooth. You know, it sucks. Yeah. You're not doing anything wrong, but that's just the world, unfortunately. Anyhow, the Persian figured out who the target of Eric's obsessive love is. It's Christine. And he didn't understand why she'd be responding to Eric, but then he discovered the trick with the voice. Oh, she didn't see him for a long time. So he built up the relationship that way. However, he was really surprised when he saw Eric placing Christine on the horse, because he was hanging around spying the first time Phantom brought her down to the lair.
Right.
Eric saw this and actually knocked his ass out for lurking around, which is funny. And when he came to, he waited around for Eric by the lake for a day or so, knowing that Eric would probably have to go out at some point for provisions.
He explained when Eric went out in public that he wore a fake nose and mustache. Mm-hmm. He wore a pasteboard nose with a mustache attached to it instead of his own horrible hole of a nose. This did not quite take away his corpse-like air, but it made him almost, I say almost, endurable to look at. So basically, Groucho glasses.
It's a perfect disguise.
The Persian was eventually found by the Phantom, and the Phantom warned him again to stay away and to keep his mouth shut. That if Eric's secrets get out, it will be a bad lookout for a goodly number of the human race.
And so that's where I'm saying this translation is kind of whack, because that is some really odd phrasing.
It is.
In my book, it says, many of the human race will suffer. Like, that's not, it will be a bad lookout for a goodly number of the human race. I mean, it sounds like somebody just kicked this text into Google Translate or something.
Yeah.
It's not terrible, but I'm just saying that.
I just thought that it was like an antiquated way of sure. saying something, or an affected way. And that's how the Phantom talked. But I guess it's just a bad translation.
I'm just saying, I think if somebody wants to read this, I would recommend get the Penguin Classics book. It's a better translation.
So the Persian explained he's not there for Eric. He's looking for Christine. And he thought she was taken against her will. Eric was pissed that the Persian would think such a thing. And he insisted that she wanted to be there and that he'll let her go to show that she will come back to him. Then Eric has some madman monologue stuff. He says, she will come back again. She loves me. All this will end in marriage. A marriage at the Madeleine, you great booby. Do you believe me now when I tell you that my nuptial mass is written? Wait till you hear the Kyrie. Kyrie! 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 Kyrie eleison. Wait till you hear that mass.
Yeah, it's totally nuts. I mean, I think that the Madeleine is a building next to the Paris Opera House that he wants to take her up to get married in. But he's singing that Mr. Mister song, is what he's singing there.
He is, yeah.
Kyrie eleison, down the road that I must travel.
That's right.
It means Lord have mercy, Kyrie eleison. Yes. When I heard that song as a kid, I didn't know that phrase. So I always thought it was give me a laser. I thought that's what he was saying. Give me a laser down the road that I must travel.
Well, that's pretty good.
Made sense to me, yeah.
I always thought he was saying Carrie Leave.
Carrie Leave?
Like Carrie, the girl's name. Carrie Leave me down a road I must travel.
Huh, interesting.
I didn't make any sense, really.
Yeah. I'm sure we weren't the only ones confused by that.
Oh, my God, no. Well,
once again, on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, you get only the most relevant references to pop culture. Mr. Mister still dominating the music charts.
Pop culture from 30 years ago. The Persian said, if you let her go and she comes back, I won't meddle in your affairs any longer. And the Phantom agreed. Mm-hmm. And now the Persian expresses that he was worried about Eric's threats to all humanity and felt that he needed to keep an eye on him. Now, the Persian explains that he watched over Christine and Raoul when they were playing engaged, and he was ready to kill Eric if need be. He knew Christine loved Raoul and not the Phantom, and that this was all going to turn really ugly really soon. When the newspapers announced that Raoul and Christine were getting married, he thought, whoop, there it is. And he considered going to the cops with all he knew about Eric, but he thought that that might actually cause more problems than solutions, and they probably would also just think that he's crazy.
Yeah.
He was amazed when he arrived to the opera house and saw that it was still standing. So after Christine's abduction, he roped in Raoul, and now we are here in the story. We're up to speed. Did we really need all this?
I mean, all we really found out was that the Persian was around for some of the things we already knew about. There's a little bit about the Persian's relationship with Eric, but this might have been a better section to fill in with some of the details on Eric's past that we get way later in the epilogue.
Yeah.
I think it would have been nice to know them during the story. But at least we get some more information here.
He recalls that Eric was really good with a rope, the Punjab lasso. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Eric lived in India and was trained in the art of strangulation. I guess he took a local community college course.
Yeah, it's the same place he's been putting up those song lesson flyers.
The Persian says that the young Sultana, which I guess is a princess, fancied mm-hmm. his killing.
Right.
He said Eric would have himself put into a courtyard and then fight with a condemned warrior for the Sultana's entertainment. The warrior would be given a pike and a sword, and Eric would just have his rope. Every time, he would kill them.
Yeah.
She liked this so much that he taught her how to kill people with a lasso, and then she just killed several women and some of her friends.
You gotta practice. You know, friends and family is a good place to start. This is why the Persian knows that the Phantom is such a dangerous adversary, though, because he's like a pit fighter. You know?
Yeah. So the whole point about telling Raoul to keep his hand up with a gun, like we said last week, it's to stop the Phantom from using the lasso around his neck.
Right.
Now, Eric used to work for the Opera House and was part of building additions and secret passageways over the years.
Yeah, so that comes up later, too, in the epilogue. And I was wondering, did he wear a mask while he was working as a contractor?
He must have.
Because they hired him to do this. It's mentioned so casually, that part of his life, that he was hired for the Opera House building. I mean, I just wonder how the interview went, and was he out with the other buildings having lunch on a beam while they were building this thing? You know, did he go there with his lunchbox? And how did he wind up getting this job?
Right, or was he like maybe the architect of the whole thing and didn't actually do the building?
I don't know.
Did he use the resume from like India and the Sultan and all that stuff? And he had references, but he couldn't use those references because they all wanted him dead, as we find out later.
Right.
We're all caught up, and now we're in the torture chamber, and the Persian is scared out of his pants.
Right. So we're here again in the present.
So the torture chamber has six walls and is covered with mirrors. There is an iron tree that allows prisoners to hang themselves if they just can't take it anymore.
And if it's hard to imagine this torture chamber, the silent film has a pretty good depiction of it, I think, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty cool because the creases where the mirrors meet each other, they have a tree trunk. So it looks like a whole tree when it's got the mirror reflected in it. It's very impressive.
And then it expands off into the distance, too. And there's so many trees, it ends up looking like a forest. It's pretty neat. Yeah. I'm glad they actually built the torture chamber to the specifications of this book.
So they hear the door open and Eric shouting, "You must make a choice, the wedding mass or the requiem mass." And they hear a moan in response and they know that Christine is with Eric.
Time to overhear some ranting.
Eric is full on crazy. He keeps putting all of this on her. If she loved him, he wouldn't kill people anymore. He doesn't want to kill, but he needs love. Christine is doing a lot of crying. I empathize with her completely. How can she deal with this madman?
Yeah, in one respect, Christine is every woman. You know, she's just trying to be patient while a bunch of guys yell at her and try to make her what they want.
Yeah.
But she's also relatable to anybody. Like, as you say, you're empathetic. Like, regardless of gender or sexuality, a lot of folks have probably had to make the choice. Like, do I go with the crazy artist who's a lot of fun and talented but really broken and ugly inside? Or do I go with the bland, boring guy or girl who will give me security and reliability? Yeah. It's that choice.
So Eric hears the sound of a bell and he says that there's someone at the door. As soon as he leaves, Raoul calls out to Christine, and Raoul tells her that he's on the other side of the wall there to help her. Christine warns Eric is going to kill everyone and himself if she doesn't marry him. She has until 11 o'clock at night the next night to decide. Christine is tied up, so she can't really help anybody. Raoul tries to get her to wiggle out and escape, but she's like, look, even if I can get out, I don't have the key. Only Eric has them, and he keeps them in a little bag he calls the Bag of Life and Death.
It's also my dice bag. I am a level 20 angel of music.
The Persian asks why she's tied up since she can't escape the lake house, and she confesses that she attempted suicide by striking my forehead against the walls.
Whoa.
Now, this makes Raoul cry, and I gotta say, this time I get it because this is so insane.
That kind of got me too. I mean, you're really desperate if you're doing that. Yeah, I felt bad for her.
They hear Eric return and then they keep quiet. Eric says that whoever was at the door won't bother them again. Christine says that the bonds are too tight and argues that she has until 11. And he says, well, I guess if we're going to die together, I might as well let you go. He says that he's ready to die. He unties her and he sees her looking at him oddly. It's because he's all wet. And he begins just kind of rambling about it raining outside and that there was a man beneath the lake and that he's got to go out and sing a requiem for him. He leaves as Raoul and the Persian try to figure out who's at the bottom of the lake. And then they hear Eric cry out, what have you done with my bag?
It has my special Vampire the Masquerade dice in it.
I need those.
Chapter 23, the torture begins. So Eric knows Christine took his bag. She runs into the other room and he follows her. She says she wants to look into the room that she never gets to see, which is the torture room. She does this in kind of a playful manner, but Eric, you don't buy it. He says, I don't like curious women.
When you get right down to it, I only really like women who are kidnapped. That's the primary thing I like in a woman.
They hear Christine cry out in pain and Eric chuckle. Of course, numbnuts can't keep his mouth shut and he growls. And of course, Eric hears him. Eric quickly figures out that it's Raoul and he says that he can look in the room and see who's inside from his invisible window.
It has something in it called glass, you see.
I think it was...
invisible!
A two-way mirror. So he can see into it, but Raoul can't see out.
It's an invisible window.
So the torture chamber then lights up and the Persian knows that this is an automated torture chamber. Eric teases her about Raoul and how handsome he is. And she begs Eric to stop and he tells her to go up the ladder and take a look inside. Christine looks in and says that there's nobody in there. And Eric notes that she looks like she's going to faint. And he asks her what she thinks, and she says it's only a forest.
And that's the illusion of the torture chamber, as we discussed. There's one tree, it's reflected in the mirrors ad infinitum, so it looks like a vast, boiling woods.
Eric says he's tired of having a torture chamber, of having trapdoors and secret passageways. He wants a nice, quiet flat with normal doors and windows and a wife.
Yeah, he's expressing this desire for normalcy. You know, he's like, this torture chamber stuff is pretty fun, but I don't want to do it forever. You know, and I get it. Opera haunting burnout. It's a real thing, I think. I don't know if you ever went to the opera here, the LA opera, but the Phantom down there should have hung it up a long time ago. You know, like he just kind of jostles the chandelier a little bit. You look in a mirror and you see him in there, but he's passed out sleeping. You know, Eric, he's on top of it. He knows. I only have so much time in the Phantom biz. So he's ready to take a normal life on with Christine.
at this point, for some reason, because he's psychotic, he wants to show her some card tricks.
We've got some time to kill. How about some close magic?
Christine begs him to turn the light out. Now, it's this light in the torture chamber that is super, super hot, and it's warming the thing up. The Phantom raises his mask up when he's talking, and she can see that his mouth doesn't move, and he is displaying the power through ventriloquism that he can make his voice come from anywhere or from anyone. He goes on another crazy monologue, making his voice come out of different areas. He does the coack Carlotta noise that she made in the opera.
Is that a real thing, throwing your voice?
No.
I've heard about that my whole life, but can you actually, can people really do that?
No.
Because the Phantom in here, it's like he can make his voice sound like it's coming from anywhere.
No, that's not possible. Sound doesn't work that way.
I know. I mean, I think that there is some kind of thing you can do to create a sort of like distance effect with your voice, so it sounds like it's coming from far away, but the point of origin still would be pretty clear,
right? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That, I don't know if I buy that throwing your voice
thing. Let's
hope them. Somebody's going to tell us we're wrong, but...
Well, I'd like to be proven wrong, because that would be really cool if that's a thing that exists in the world. Christine becomes quite warm and remarks on the heat. Eric, in full evil villain laughing mode, tells her the torture room forest is from Africa. And he laughs so loudly, that's all anyone can hear.
And then we get back into the torture chamber.
The lights in the room produce so much heat that the room becomes unbearably hot. The Persian says that they must keep their wits about themselves and that there are marks on the wall, as if someone had been put there before. Maybe Joseph Bouquet?
Yeah, I would explain his death, because hanging from the branch of the iron tree is a noose, which I think we mentioned. And when the heat becomes unbearable, one has the option of hanging oneself. So that's probably what happened to Bouquet.
So Rule starts to get angry and freak out, and the Persian knows that he has to calm him down if they're going to get out of this place. Eric must have a way to escape out of this. He wouldn't build something that there's no way to get out of, because that's part of his bag. The Persian is searching for some panels, and he feels like he's onto something when Raoul just gives up and lies down. Trying to deal with baby Raoul and his baby ways, the Persian loses track of where he was, and he has to start his search all over again. Now, the big baby Raoul starts whining about being thirsty, and of course the Persian's thirsty too, but he's not whining about it. And then they hear a roar of a lion. That freaks Raoul out. He's delirious, thinking it's real, but the Persian suspects again that's Eric doing some of his special tricks. But Raoul is so freaked out he fires his gun and it shatters one of the mirrors. This goes on all night. Eric is making animal sounds, Raoul and the Persian getting more and more delirious. Raoul's ready to kill himself, as is the Persian, but he sees something, a nail in the floor, and he pushes on that nail and it opens the trapdoor.
He found it. He found that out that he knew was there. I do wish the Persian had used some kind of background info on Eric or something to figure out how to escape.
Yeah.
It just seemed like he looked long enough until he found the thing. It was almost an accident. I mean, he used background information a little, knowing that there would be a way out. But I wish there'd been something more specific.
So they go down some stairs and they find some barrels that they hope have water inside, but when they open them, they find they are filled with gunpowder.
We shouldn't drink that.
Now, the Persian knows that Eric plans to blow up the opera house at 11 o'clock at night. It would be full of people, and Christine's choice will affect hundreds, or if not thousands, of people that are at the opera.
Rigging the building to explode, as we all know, it's the best way to finish up a story. At least it puts a, it puts a clock on things.
Yeah, exactly. So they go back to the torture chamber and they see that the lights are off. They call out to Christine and to Eric. They hear footsteps in Christine's voice. She explains that Eric has been cruel to her all day and has left her alone to decide. She only has 5 minutes left until it's 11. Eric gave her a key that will open up two boxes in her room. In one of the cases, you'll find a scorpion, the other grasshopper. If you turn the scorpion around, it will mean that you'll be with me. But if you turn the grasshopper, that means no. So there's some kind of mechanism hooked up with these things. Eric laughed evilly as he left, saying the grasshopper does not only turn, it hops. And the Persian figured out that the grasshopper was this trigger to set off the explosives.
Right.
So she's going to turn the scorpion, but the Persian says, don't do that. It might be another trick. And then Eric returns. The Persian tries to plead with him, but he demands the Persian's silence. Eric says that the scorpion will blow up a quarter of Paris, but the grasshopper will flood the gunpowder.
Now, in the silent film, she just went ahead and made that choice. She turned the scorpion, and then suddenly, which is the right choice, because it'll stop the explosion, but the way to stop the explosion is that that gunpowder room gets flooded, which will kill Raoul and the Persian.
Right.
So you see the trick in action. I think it was better to just see it happen rather than here, where Eric directly explains what's going to happen, you know, why it's an impossible choice.
She chooses the scorpion, and we hear the flood of water, and it begins to fill up the torture chamber. She tells him to turn off the water, but Eric ignores her, and the room fills up, and the Persian and Raoul begin to drown. And that ends that chapter. So we're in chapter 16, the end of the ghost's love story. That ends the Persian's written narrative. And the author says, at this point, I get all this information from talking to him. He tells me this stuff.
Yeah, this is when LaRue visited the Persian. We heard it way at the beginning of the book.
Yes. The Persian awakened to find himself in bed. Raoul was on a sofa. Eric and Christine are looking down on them. The room is simple and middle class, not like the lavish goth place that the Phantom had before.
Right, yeah. I mean, they blacked out in the flooding and just wake up in this nice room. And it's a weird scene, actually, you know, because Christine and the Phantom are there together and they just kind of wake up and it's like they're guests that have just been visiting or something because it's so commonplace.
So Eric whispers to the Persian that the furniture is all that he has left of his unhappy mother. And Christine silently brings a glass of tea to Eric and Eric gives it to the Persian. Raoul is sound asleep. Eric says that he will take them outside and that they are safe. This is to please his wife. Mm-hmm. The Persian then falls asleep, seemingly drugged from the tea, only to wake up outside his own flat. When he gets himself together, the Persian wants to find out what happened to Raoul. Word is that Philippe was found dead on the bank of the opera lake. He must have been the one that came down and rang the bell and Eric went out and killed. Mm-hmm. The Persian figures that Philippe must have recalled his brother's explanations of what was underneath the opera house and he made it down there looking for his brother and Christine. The Persian is pissed and he goes to the police and tells them what he knows, but the magistrate thinks the Persian is nuts. At his home, the Persian has a visitor. It's Eric. Pissed off, he goes after Eric, calling him a murderer. But Eric, looking weak, says that Philippe was an accident. He didn't do it. He found Philippe drowned. And the Persian, of course, doesn't believe him.
Yeah, he totally did it. What a
he
liar.
He totally did it. The Persian asks about Raoul and Christine, but Eric just announces that he's going to die. Then Eric says this ultra creepy thing. I am dying of love. If you knew how beautiful she was, wouldn't she let me kiss her? It was the first time, Daroga, the first time I ever kissed a woman. Yes, alive. I kissed her alive, as she looked as beautiful as if she had been dead.
Whoa.
Man, that's creepy. Mm-hmm. It seems Christine let Eric kiss her on the forehead, and she didn't recoil. Since not even his mother ever did that, he felt so deeply that he began to cry with her. And Christine said to him, poor, unhappy Eric.
And she took his hand. I mean, this pity from Christine, it makes Eric redeem himself. It's odd. In the movie, this moment happens in the 1925 movie. And you see him you see the Phantom trying to determine, should I let her go with Raoul? Am I being a jerk? But then the Phantom says, screw it. He takes Christine anyway.
Yeah.
He steals Raoul's carriage. They take off, pursued by an angry mob. They did add an angry mob to the movie, and that's important. Yeah. But Eric jumps out of the overturned carriage, and the mob grabs him. And they just beat the hell out of him, and then they throw him in the river to drown. And that's the end of the movie. I thought it was so interesting how the original text has him as being somewhat sympathetic and redeemed at the end. Mm-hmm. I believe the musical has that as well. Mm-hmm. But in the 1925 films, 20s, 30s, you know, if there's a monster in the movie, they're really a monster, so they need to be dispatched. It's just a different... Yeah. I mean, this kind of ending is better for a like more modern sympathetic audience. We like our monsters to be sympathetic. But in that 25 movie, it's a righteous mob and a killed monster. You know? It's like it's kind of a different world, I guess.
It was a different world when you had righteous mobs. Mm-hmm. In the book, however, knowing Christine loved Raoul, he gave her his ring and he told her to give it to Raoul as a wedding present. Eric let them both go. Christine and Raoul kissed in front of him. Mm-hmm. And he only asked when Christine heard about his death that she would make sure the ring was buried with him. He told her where to find his body when she got word that he was dead.
Yeah, I mean, it's that thing. I only want you to be, I love you so much, I just want you to be happy. He actually meant it at this point.
So Eric left and then sent the Persian all of Christine's papers that she wrote. And Raoul and Christine left for the north, where they were married. 3 weeks later, the Persian published an ad in the newspaper that read, Eric is dead.
That's the whole story. And then we get this epilogue.
The narrator says that this and the papers should be proof enough that Eric existed. The Phantom was a real guy. Mm. No one suspected that Christine went up north and lived with Raoul, which I don't understand how he got away with this. Like, he was nobility.
Yeah, I mean, they just ran away together, basically. Yeah. I think that they didn't want to be happily married while his brother had just been murdered. Probably right. Better to escape.
And also, Madame Valerius disappeared with around the same time. So it looks like they took her with them.
She went with them, yeah.
Before his death, it seemed that Eric returned the money to the managers, who then concluded that the whole thing was a big joke.
Yeah, and it's not that he didn't need or use their money as they were giving it to him as a salary. It's just that it turns out the Phantom, in addition to magic and singing, is also incredible with money management. And so he earned enough back that he could repay the managers. So it kind of redeems himself monetarily as well.
So the author says, if you ever visit the Opera House, go to box 5, tap on the pillar there. It's hollow and it's big enough for a man to hide inside it.
Which was an obvious trick. I mean, we always knew that. But then we get a whole bunch of backstory on the Phantom.
According to the Persian, Eric had been born in a small town near Rouen and was the son of a builder. His ugliness filled his parents with horror and fear, and he ran away from home at an early age. For a time, he was exhibited at fairs, where showmen advertised him as the living corpse. He must have crossed the whole of Europe, going from fair to fair, and completed his unconventional education as an artist and magician among the Romani. He had already developed a unique singing voice, and his displays of ventriloquism and magic were so dazzling that they were a constant topic of conversation among travelers. Eric's reputation reached as far as the Mazandaran Palace, where the young Sultana, the Shah's favorite, was suffering from intense boredom and summoned him. Thus, Eric came to Persia, and for a while enjoyed great influence at court. Seemingly unable to distinguish between right and wrong, he committed quite a few crimes during this period. He took part in a number of cold-blooded political assassinations, and he turned his diabolical inventive powers against the Emir of Afghanistan, who was at war with the Persian Empire. When the Shah heard of Eric's highly original ideas on the subject of architecture, he conceived of a building as a box of tricks, he asked him to design and construct a new palace. The results were said to be ingenious. His Majesty was able to come and go within the edifice without being seen, and to appear and disappear, as if by magic.
So yeah, boom, a lot of information, a lot of backstory.
The Shah was going to have everybody killed who worked on this project because he wanted it to be secret, including Eric. But the Persian, this is how he comes into the story, helped him escape and faked his death.
I think that the Persian must have been an inspector for the Shah. But in this, he got wind of what was going to happen and he saved Eric.
Now, Eric went to Constantinople, where he entertained the Sultan, and he made him some automaton doubles so that the Sultan could trick people. But then the Sultan also thought that Eric knew too much and was going to have him killed.
Bad idea, because if they were automatons that could actually fool people, that it was the Sultan, then that means he was basically making androids up over there. So that's pretty amazing. This is a talented guy.
He then went to Paris and lived in the opera house, making it, over time, his own tricksy place.
The reader knows the rest. Poor, unhappy Eric. Should we pity him or should we curse him? He simply longed to be someone normal. But his hideous appearance would not allow it. With an ordinary face, he would have been one of the most distinguished of mankind. He had a big heart, large enough to embrace the entire world. But in the end, he had to confine himself to a dismal cellar. Yes, all in all, the Phantom of the Opera deserves our pity. I have prayed over his mortal remains, that God might show him mercy notwithstanding his crimes. It was his skeleton they discovered beneath the opera. I did not recognize it by the ugliness of the head, for all men are ugly when they have been dead as long as that, but by the plain gold ring which he wore and which Christine Daae had certainly slipped on his finger when she came to bury him in accordance with her promise. The skeleton was lying near the little well in the place where the angel of music first held Christine Daae fainting in his trembling arms on the night when he carried her down to the cellars of the opera house. And now, what do they mean to do with that skeleton? Surely it cannot be thrown into a pauper's grave. I say that the rightful place for the remains of the Phantom of the Opera is in the archives of the National Academy of Music. After all, it is no ordinary skeleton.
And that is the end of The Phantom of the Opera. You know, I talked a lot about those two big adaptations, the musical and the 1925 film, but there was also my genius Phantom of the Octagon idea, which I'm working on now. But there are a few other notable adaptations. I don't know if you've seen any of these. There was the Robert Englund one in 1989.
Oh, right.
Which I think in that one, it was more the Phantom made a deal with the devil or something like that, so that he could be so great at music, and as a result, the punishment was that he has a disfigured face. Had an angle like that. And then there's the Claude Rains 1943 one, which actually, that's the one that seems to get pushed on people the most. So I don't know if this is similar to that thing we had going on with Jekyll and Hyde. You know, they had the earlier movie, but then they had the later Spencer Tracy movie, and then it's, you know, the studio decided that's the one they wanted to push later on. I think it's the same issue here, but that one, again, it has a thing where they get into the origin of the Phantom. I think that's the one, I haven't seen it, but I think that's the one where acid was thrown in his face.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the cause of his disfigurement, which I believe was my first, I thought that that was the origin of the Phantom, you know, when I read the book. So I don't even though I didn't see the movie, I think that got into my head somewhere. And then there's, Dario Argento made a couple of them. He did an adaptation that's just called Opera, and I haven't seen that one, I heard much about it, but there was one later he did in 98 called The Phantom of the Opera that had Julian Sands in it.
That's
an interesting one because Julian Sands is not disfigured in that. He just was an orphan that was raised by rats in the cellar. No kidding. Raised by rats. I don't know how that works. But he was raised by rats in the cellar of the opera house. And in that, they kind of make this rat catcher character a bit more of a nemesis to him. So he's like, he'll do anything to protect his rats. And it's more about that, which is a really weird interpretation of this story.
How bizarre. One of my favorite adaptations of this is The Phantom of the Paradise.
Yes, and then there's, of course, The Phantom of the Paradise, Brian De Palma's maybe first movie. It's an early De Palma movie.
And that was scored by Paul Williams, and he also played the disfigured Phantom.
Yeah, I believe it was him I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's somebody that worked on that, but I believe it was Paul Williams. Because he recently just did some stuff with Daft Punk as well. He was talking about how, you know, be careful of evaluating your failures and successes, because Phantom of the Paradise is sort of a cult movie now.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came out, it was quite a bomb. You know,
oh, sure.
He felt really bad about it. Did a whole album of music for it that he didn't think anybody liked. But he was busy doing something in Mexico, and this kid came up and had the LP of Phantom of the Paradise. And was like, I love this movie. Will you sign this for me? This is a total Paul Harvey story. But at the end, he's like, and you know who that guy was? Guillermo del Toro. Who has since asked me to work on his movies and stuff. So he was just like, you know, you might have a bomb, but it can always be looked at through a different lens. Later on, try not to beat yourself up too bad about it.
It's a B movie, but it's so interesting and strange and weird that I highly recommend watching it. Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, it's a good one. And there's a documentary that I saw recently about Brian De Palma that talks about that movie. And that was interesting as well, because he's got a really odd career, De Palma. But that's a subject for another show at another time.
It is.
Merry Christmas, everybody. I hope you're having a wonderful holiday season. I thought Phantom of the Opera would be a fun one for Christmas because it's got so many, it's so vibrant. And I enjoyed reading it again. I got to say, I'm a little glad we're at the conclusion of it. The book was a little more ponderous than I remembered it being.
It starts off really strong, gets pretty bad in the in the third quarter, but
yeah.
I think it rounds up pretty good.
Yeah, it does. All in all, I really enjoy it and was glad we got to cover it. It was one of the classics I always wanted to cover. And I want to thank Jamie Andrews for taking the ride along with us.
Oh my God, she's amazing. Thank you so much, Jamie.
You are great. Make sure to catch her in Greenland later this year with Gerard Butler. And I also want to thank some of our patrons, and I'm going to start with Mikhail Kerr.
I'd like to thank That B-Word Podcast.
I'd like to thank Michael Ciccone.
I'd like to thank Eric Danielson.
Gino Moscati, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Anthony Weir.
P.S. Glory, thank you.
Thank you, Pamela A. Glazier.
Thank you, Swan Windish.
And lastly, thank you, Lars Backstrom.
Our old friend Lars, we love him.
We love him dearly.
That's all we've got for this month. Happy New Year, everybody. We'll be back at you soon with some, we've got a whole batch of oddly assorted stories we're going to do in January. We're calling it New Fears. It's sort of a potpourri. So we'll be back with those. Get ready for some short story action after this long novel. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.